Welcome to week four of Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We've got a packed hour today, Avi. First off, with the Philadelphia mayor's race less than a month away, we're continuing our conversations with the candidates. And we have former city council member at large Helen Gimm here. And that's coming up shortly.
And then after that, it's been a year. 1 year anniversary of legal pot in New Jersey, cannabis, I should say. Mm-hmm. We want to know how the industry is shaking out. What do residents think? We want to hear from you as well. Are you a cannabis consumer in New Jersey? Or maybe you're just a resident who has some concerns or questions about the changes that took place over the past year. Give us a call. Our phone lines are already open, 888-477-9499, or email us studio2@whyy.org. But first, the news roundup, Cherry, and the eyes of the world on Delaware.
On Delaware yet again. Dominion Voting Systems, $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit against Fox News. It kicks off today in a Delaware Superior Court. You heard it here on NPR earlier. We remember that those Dominion voting machines, they were part of conspiracy theories about voter fraud in the 2020 election. They've been proven false time and time again. But the big question is whether or not Fox hosts and Fox executives acted with actual malice. That is, that they knew all of those facts about Dominion were false and that they worked to share those facts anyway, mm-hmm. and that their motive was ratings. There's a lot to prove there. The other big question is whether or not Dominion's case is worth $1.6 billion. That won't be easy, but if Dominion is successful, it will be one of the biggest lawsuits in media history ever.
I remember in school, they would always tell us it's so hard to prove defamation against a media company. The standard's very high in this country specifically. So we'll see if Dominion will meet that standard. We also wanted to note, since this happened since the last time we were on the air, that U.S. Senator John Fetterman returned to the U.S. Senate yesterday following treatment for clinical depression. In February, Senator Fetterman checked himself into Walter Reed Hospital for inpatient treatment for clinical depression, and then he went back to Braddock, where he lives, in late March, and now he's back in Washington.
Yeah, and today he has a big, you know, job. He's going to be chairing his first Senate committee hearing on SNAP, which is, you know, government food assistance. And so that's a big deal, you know, given, you know, all that he's been through. And so I look forward to seeing, you know, what he does now that he's back in the Senate. The other big story that we're talking about is the Fashion District. They've imposed a 2 p.m. curfew for young people under age 18. It's essentially these young people are banned from the mall after that time unless they have a parent or supervising adult over age 23. All of this started on Monday. The reaction is it is what it is, but this is the result of, you know, large groups of teens sort of gathering downtown, causing a little bit of a ruckus. But, you know, I don't know about you, Avi, but when I was a teenager, I spent a lot of time in the mall. I worked in the mall. Yeah. They say teens who work there can still show their ID. But security guards are constantly going to be asking those who look under 18 for their ID.
Yeah, I can't recall anything like this ever. I mean, part of the lifeblood of a mall economically, let's forget the public safety side of it. I don't even know how a mall is supposed to make money, exist, have a vibrant sort of life without groups of teenagers hanging out after school.
That's like what they do.
That's like core mall stuff. So it's unusual. I don't really understand how the Fashion District is supposed to exist as a business going forward. Clearly, they think this is the right way forward. The whole thing is sort of confusing, and it does seem unprecedented to me. Maybe someone will correct me. I don't remember anything like this ever happening.
I'm going to put on my cynical hat. Yeah. You know, I'm going to think there could be some issues with security guards constantly, like, asking teenagers.
Yeah, like bouncers at a club.
Oh, my God. I'm hoping that doesn't happen, but, you know, hey, it is what it is.
Well, we're going to pivot now to our newsmaker interview, someone who has a lot to say about the future of the city and downtown spaces. This is part of our series of interviews with Philly's mayoral candidates. Helen Gimm, who joins us right now, was a city council member at large from 2016 until last year. Before that, she was an educator and an education activist, among many other things. Helen Gimm, welcome to Studio 2.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here with you all.
Wonderful. And so this was a big week for you. It's only Tuesday, but still, public safety has been the number one issue in the city of Philadelphia. You announced a comprehensive safety plan. We do have a lot to get to, but I want you to take a minute or two and just kind of, you know, lay it all out for us.
Absolutely. I think, you know, for the city of Philadelphia, we need a real transformation in how we're looking at safety. And I know this, that safe cities invest in people. I've made very clear on the day that we announced that we were going to have a public safety mission for the city of Philadelphia that declared gun violence a public health emergency, that, you know, talked about how we are going to deploy people right away because people need to see safety personnel on their streets. But it's different for us. I want to promote more detectives so we can actually solve crimes. I want to deploy mobile mental health crisis response units so people can get situations taken care of that don't require policing. And I want to make sure that there are more group violence and community trusted individuals on the streets to interrupt as violence interrupters, because a lot of the youth who are involved or are in the path of violence don't actually talk to police officers. I think our plan gets more people out on the streets faster in a targeted way and directly addresses the concerns that Philadelphians have, which is we need to make sure that we have our emergency calls responded to. We want crimes to be solved because the most lawless thing about Philadelphia is that too many people get away with things. And we need emergencies that don't require police intervention, that require de-escalation, like mental health, like addiction issues, like homelessness, and you know, and potentially even domestic violence. Just reducing and de-escalating and putting trained individuals out there who can actually do that work.
Yeah, and you definitely have some attention-getting ideas, including guaranteed employment for some at-risk young people. But you've also been quoted as saying, Helen, that you do not have a plan for paying for this. Is that correct?
That's not accurate.
Okay.
So what we said very clearly was there is a plan to do this. So, for example, about 50% of the young people who apply for summer youth employment never make it through the actual process because they lack documentation, they can't complete the application, or they just never get through it. So my plan is to make sure that we actually get all those young people through it, so we get 100% participation in our youth programming. That's what I mean by guaranteed employment. And what we do with that is we allow for individuals to be on site to help teens and young adults get registered for these summer youth programs. Again, these are programs that are provided for and are adjusted, and now we need to just finish the application process. 50% is unacceptable. We should be at 100%. That's an easy way for me to talk about why I believe we can get to 100% in guaranteed jobs.
That's more of a goal than a pledge to say, if you are under this age, you will be employed and we will be sure of that.
I will make sure that any young person who applies for a job actually makes sure that they finish the application and gets and is able to finish and get to the employment that they choose to do. I'm obviously not going to do child labor practices, right. So I'm not trying to force anyone into a job, but I want to commit that if 50% of young people start applications for summer programs and never make it, that's an unacceptable number. I need them to get the help that they need. And that is on site, because we did this at Dobbins High School last year to actually work with young people to figure out who is their point of contact, how will we make sure that they get the emails back, how are they going to get to their next interview, and then how do we make sure that they have the resources they need to get back and forth to the job that they're assigned to. I would like to see more jobs in neighborhoods and communities, and I definitely think we can expand our out-of-school time dollars to provide more summer opportunities in neighborhoods and communities so young people don't have to travel so far and deal with SEPTA costs or other things.
You have an ambitious proposal that you're calling a Green New Deal for Philadelphia schools. It involves spending at least, right, $10 billion over a decade on facilities improvements. That's a big number. Have you calculated how much debt the school district would have to take out in order to cover that cost?
Yeah, first of all, I think it's an absolutely acceptable, reasonable number, and I'll tell you why. First, I do want to tell you what's not an acceptable cost. What's not an acceptable cost is to have four school 4 schools close down in 2 weeks, including Frankfurt High School and Mitchell Elementary School, which are in some of the most, you know, high crime areas of our city, and have those children be told that they have to go to school virtually for the rest of the year. That is an unacceptable number. It's also unacceptable to have a list of 279 schools that the district has itself identified as having asbestos and potentially being at risk. It is not acceptable for us to not have a plan for the next 10 years. My plan is actually not unreasonable. The School District of Philadelphia already borrows every other year. It is reasonable for us to consider a borrowing plan of $2 billion split between the school district and the city of Philadelphia over a 10-year period that puts us on a path to school modernization, to planning and efforts. The district has already committed around $2.5 billion over the next 4 years, for example, as an example of that. And the city should match it. This is something that we need to plan for. I believe it's something that we can start by talking about. You know, I've talked about a millage shift, for example, to make sure that more dollars of our property tax goes towards school funding without raising the property tax. And I do believe that we can get many of our private actors, nonprofits, philanthropic entities, and businesses on board with leveraging this in, along with state and local funding that should be available.
But I was a little surprised that there wasn't a property tax hike as part of this proposal, because I understand you're saying that there have been quite a number of capital dollars already proposed, but $10 billion is far bigger than anyone else has thrown out there.
I don't think anybody else has actually come up with a real plan to actually modernize schools. I don't think it's about the money. Nobody even has the plan to even be able to do it. But I think what we laid out very clearly is we have to have a plan to modernize schools. We cannot say that over the next 10 years, kids go to school without air conditioning,
sure,
in toxic conditions of lead, asbestos, and mold, when Lower Merion just opened a brand new public middle school that cost $90 million.
No, I don't think anyone's saying that.
Well, I think, you know, the most important thing for us is that we've laid out a plan. The district actually has a plan that's very similar. And my proposal is for the city to match what the district is putting forward. And I do believe that we can start that. We should absolutely get it underway. We should map out what this starts to look like. And I think that the funding is going to start to come through afterwards.
But can you put a number on the debt service that it would require?
I think that the debt service is around, you know, you can say that debt service might be $50 million for every billion that you're trying to raise. And okay, as I said, if you're trying to raise
$500 million,
well, we're not doing it all at once, though. So it's unreasonable to say that we're not going to borrow $10 billion right now for projects that are, you know, a decade down the road. We are getting underway the projects that need to be done over the next 4 years and moving quickly and swiftly, laying out a plan to do it. And I do think that the efficiency by which we get it done, our success and our competence in being able to do it, will bring in more federal and state dollars.
And I want to ask you this last question. You've been an activist taking strong stances on a number of issues. And, you know, if you are elected mayor, you will not have, it will be by a plurality of vote. How will you go from being a fighter to a consensus builder?
Well,
you have 20 seconds.
Yeah. If I could just, you know, to be clear, I don't consider myself just being an activist. I'm considering myself who's actually gotten things done. We delivered clean water to every child in every school. We made sure that we modernized school buildings. This is transformational change, and I'm the person who has actually delivered on big change. And now it's time for a big transformation for the city and not the same old politics that hold us back.
The voters can take it from there. Thanks so much for joining us, Helen Gim. Helen Gim is a former Philadelphia City Council member at large. Coming up, shifting over to New Jersey and talking about legal cannabis. Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Studio 2. Good afternoon. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Legal cannabis in New Jersey turned 1 year old this week. Can you believe it, Avi? It's been a year. It took decades to reach the landmark of legalization, but that was just the beginning.
It is indeed just the beginning. We want to know who's profiting, who isn't, and what does the next evolution of a legal weed marketplace look like in the Garden State? So to help answer those questions, we've brought in reporter Mike Davis, who covers the New Jersey cannabis scene for the Asbury Park Press and the USA Today Network. Mike, welcome to Studio 2.
Hey, Avi. Hey, Chai. Great to be here.
Yes, and of course, we want to hear from you. How do you feel about the cannabis industry rollout in New Jersey? Is legalization working in the Garden State? Call us at 888-477-9499 or email us your comments or questions at studio2@whyy.org, and that's 2 like the number.
All right, Mike, I want to start here. How many people are spending how much on cannabis in New Jersey? And how does that line up with expectations for the first year?
So I think you got to look at this in two different avenues, right? So if you look at the legal market, people are buying cannabis at New Jersey dispensaries. There's no doubt about that. Now, what I don't think we've seen is what the big numbers that were thrown out there when this was being discussed a couple years ago, right after Governor Murphy was elected. The tax revenue is what we're seeing. I mean, you're talking about the data we have from the Cannabis Regulatory Commission, which are the folks in charge of all of this in New Jersey. What they're saying is that we've seen about $200 million spent on recreational cannabis, and that data is about 2 quarters behind. So we're looking at Q2 and Q3 from there. You know, that's a lot of money. That's a big number, at least on paper. But when you compare this to other states, I don't think we've really seen the cannabis industry hit the ground running like we thought it would. Mm. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But I just think, you know, when you look at a brand new industry starting from scratch, what's a year, right? A year is nothing when you're talking about something that's supposed to last for a lifetime.
So, yeah, were the projections too optimistic, or is there something wrong with the marketplace that's not functioning like people thought? Like, why aren't they hitting the targets they thought they were going to hit?
Yeah, so I think when those numbers were thrown out years ago, I think people were comparing New Jersey to a lot of states that were going live at the time, you know, starting the cannabis industry. And those states were places like Colorado. California is obviously huge, but there was some of that thrown out there. Places like Massachusetts. And all of those states had these pretty robust medical marijuana programs in place. Mm. And in just about every state, when you start selling legal weed, the first places that open up are these medical marijuana dispensaries, because it's easy. They have the infrastructure. It's just a matter of taking on new customers. New Jersey never had that in place. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the time the sale started last year, there were only 23 dispensaries in the state. You're talking about a state of 9 million people, and you're talking about a product that you theoretically want to sell to as many of them as possible. So I just don't think that – I think the numbers were a little bit optimistic, but also the industry itself has been – hasn't grown the level that I think people expected at this point. And I think there's a little bit of, you know, purpose there, because the last thing you want is to start an industry from scratch and have it collapse. So I think there's a little bit of targeted growth there, that they wanted to grow a little bit at a time. And that's what a lot of the regulations do.
Yeah, I want to dig into a little bit more why, you know, New Jersey hasn't, you know, the weed market hasn't exploded. And I want to talk about the price, because one of the things that stuck out to me was that cannabis, recreational cannabis in New Jersey, it ain't cheap. It's not a, true, you're not getting a dime bag for a dime here.
Yeah. You know, just about the average price that you'll see is about $60 for an eighth, which works out to over $500 for an ounce. And there's no real bulk discount, you know, like you might expect. I mean, at least not a normal high quality flower. And in my reporting, I mean, that's the most expensive in the country. I mean, it's far above what you'll see in some of the really historic legal weed states like Colorado. But it's still about double the price what you're seeing in Massachusetts. And those places have you know, much more taxes than what New Jersey has on it. And I think there's two things here. I think number one is there's just not a lot of supply. The way that New Jersey is set up, there's only 10 cultivators right now that are actually permitted to grow cannabis and then give it to dispensaries to use for adult use. So only 10 cultivators. And at the same time, you know, right now there are 24 dispensaries selling recreational, but they're only owned by 10 companies. So there's really not a lot of competition. And I think every one of those would be more than happy selling cannabis for that price, as long as people are buying it. And I think the numbers we've seen is that people are buying it. Now, the other part of that is that there's still a black market out there. There's still a gray market out there. And the prices that you're seeing on the gray market, you know, they have these delivery companies. You know, you could get an ounce for the price of, you know, a quarter, basically, if you go to the legal weed folks in the dispensaries.
Because the whole purpose of, you know, you know, recreational marijuana is to sort of, you know, close out this black market, right, and to bring in, you know, tax revenue and other types of revenue for the state. It doesn't seem like that is happening, at least at the 1 year mark in New Jersey.
I think there's an immense interest in those folks to get into the legal industry. I will shout out one person, which is the legendary NJ Weedman, Ed mm-hmm. Fortune, who has been running in Trenton for a while. And he finally got a license, and he's in the process of transforming his business into a licensed dispensary. But that's just one. If you look at the numbers, the state has gotten in a little over 1,800 applications for cannabis licenses so far. Only about 25% of those are what they call social equity applicants, which are those folks that have a marijuana arrest on their record, or they're coming from one of these cities that have been ravaged by the war on drugs. And the number 17% of folks actually have that previous marijuana conviction on the record. But the thing is, when you look at those applications that have actually gone forth to get an annual license, you know, the last thing you need before you can really get going and get ready to open up shop, those numbers like dramatically dwindle to the teens, like the teens number of applicants. Like you're talking about between 10 and 20 total. Cool.
If you're just joining us on Studio 2, we are talking with Mike Davis, who is a reporter for the Asbury Park Press and the USA Today Network and covers the cannabis industry in New Jersey. It's been a year since adult-use cannabis was legalized in New Jersey. Time does fly. One of the things that I noted in your reporting, Mike, is this overriding sense that we thought this could be a space for mom-and-pop operators, folks from New Jersey, to stand up an operation, get it going, make some money, feed that money back into the community. And yet, it did seem like a lot of the folks who at this point are in the game are multi-state or maybe even multi-country operators, bigger players. Is that going to be the state of play moving forward? Is that going to even out? What's your sense of where that goes?
Yeah, so I think it depends on who you ask, Avi, because the way the industry is right now with those multi-state operators, I think that was expected. Because like I said, in all of these states, the first places that open up shop are these medical marijuana dispensaries. And because of the way the laws in New Jersey had been under the Christie administration, they were all multi-state operators. Now, I think the folks at the Cannabis Regulatory Commission, they want this to be a really big, open industry for mom and pops. I mean, 1,800 applications in the span of a year, that's a lot. And they've really gone through most of them and given people answers on whether they're in or out. I think the problem what you're seeing is that there's two avenues here, right? There's the state. And the state is more than happy to give a lot of people a license. But then there's the municipality, and the way that the New Jersey laws are written, and most states, honestly, you need approval from the town before you actually set up shop there. And in New Jersey, you're just not seeing buy-in from the local municipalities. Only about 35% of the municipalities in New Jersey are allowing any type of cannabis business, you know, including your cultivators, your manufacturers. You're really only talking about a quarter of the towns in New Jersey that actually allow dispensaries. So you have this kind of really cutthroat industry that is huge and booming and that naturally brings a lot of competition. But in New Jersey, you really have companies that are fighting over these individual little towns. And a lot of the ordinances in those towns really say you can only open a business on this particular street. So really, you're fighting against these big, giant companies for one piece of property on Main Street. And what we've heard from these small mom-and-pop folks, the folks that are putting their life savings into starting a cannabis business, they just can't compete. Some of these towns are charging $10,000 for an annual license, and that just completely goes against what the state is trying to do, which is to make it easy for people to get in. I mean, if you want a micro business license from the state, and that has some restrictions that basically keep you as a small business with, you know, only serving only having a limited amount of space to grow cannabis or a limited number of employees, you can get a license for that for, you know, a couple thousand dollars just total for the entire state license. These towns want $10,000 a year.
Wow.
Some of these towns want $10,000 a year just to stay in business.
So how do you change that? Because we are a local control nation. So is there anything the state can do to incentivize municipalities to change their posture here?
I think that's the key, is incentivizing, making it seem like there's a reason for them to get involved. Now, you know, I live in New Jersey. Money talks, right? So if you're a town that you said, straight up, I don't want this anywhere in our town. I don't want it I don't want it on Main Street. I don't want it in the little industrial area. I don't want it at all. And then you realize the town next door is getting a couple million dollars a year in tax revenue. All of a sudden, it makes a little bit of sense. Like, yeah, you know, we could use that. You know, we've got a public contract coming up. We've got a little bit of a tax levy issue. We could use some of that money. And I think that'll go a long way. I think also, you know, public opinion on this kind of stuff is expected to change. I mean, it's changed in the last decade. It's changed in the last number of decades. And I think even, I think the more that this, that cannabis pops up in towns across the state, I think you're going to see it become a little bit more normalized in those towns and make it a little less weird when you're talking about, hey, should we have a business like this in our town? And why shouldn't we at this point?
I want to jump in here and talk about and kind of piggyback on this whole, you know, channel of discussion, because, you know, Black and brown communities were, you know, criminalized for use of marijuana. And it was said that when these industries would open up in states, there would be opportunities to sort of, you know, balance the playing field and let people of color in on the ground floor of this industry. How is New Jersey doing with regard to this effort, bringing in minority-owned businesses and giving them dispensaries and licenses to sell cannabis legally?
Yeah, well, so I think you got to look at it from the state and local angle again, Jerry. So on a state level, the way the law is written, it gives very specific privileges to those folks that come from a social equity background, you know, folks that have a conviction or come from these cities. It gives a little bit of a leg up to diversely owned businesses, which is seen as a way to get Black and brown people involved, but also women and veterans. And then you have these impact zones, which are, again, a different kind of a city that's been hit by the war on drugs. And every time you hit one of those categories, you get a leg up. So theoretically, a social equity business is at the front of the line to get a license from the state. And even within that, if you want a micro business license, which I talked about, those are those small business licenses, you get an extra leg up. And if you want a conditional license, which is basically like a preliminary license you get from the state that basically says, hey, don't let us hold you up. You know, tell the folks in the town, tell the landlord or whatever that you got our approval. If you need one of those, if you don't have the money or the property to get an annual license yet, that also gives you a leg up. So what the state has done is really put a pretty intricate framework in place to make sure that the folks that they want to get the licenses are at the front of the line. The issue, though, is that though there is no law or anything like that says the municipalities have to agree to the same thing. And if you're a municipality, you want stability. And if you have a company that comes in and says, hey, we've run these in states across the country, here's exactly what we're going to be able to bring in the first year, here's all the staff we're going to bring in, here's all the different kinds of events we're going to be able to run and things like that, it's kind of hard for some of these municipalities to say no. And part of that is just a lack of education, because they're coming into this from the outside in. They weren't involved in the writing of the law and the activism. And some of it is frankly just, hey, we want a stable business. We want a business that's going to come in, give us some tax revenue, and be here for a lifetime. And it just, for some of these municipalities, it seems like that's a little bit more of an easier sell than getting a mom and pop in who's just trying to start their first business for the first time.
It's that same tension, state versus local. Yeah.
Are there any municipalities that are doing well and are friendly to these types of businesses?
Yeah, I think you've seen them on and off. And I will say, when I talk about the $10,000 licenses, that's not the norm. I think you are seeing plenty of towns that aren't charging anything for a license. You're seeing some towns that are charging a couple $100 for a license. South Jersey in particular has been pretty friendly to the cannabis industry from the get-go. I think you have the biggest concentration of towns that actively said, yes, we want these businesses in here. So I think it's a little bit easier there than North Jersey, where I think, frankly, you have an area that is politically leans to the left. But when you go on a local level, I think you have folks that pay a lot of money in taxes, and they really want to have a big say in what those neighborhoods look like.
Interesting. A little NIMBYism there. If you want to join
a little bit of NIMBYism, that's exactly right.
If you want to join our conversation about the 1 year anniversary of New Jersey legalizing adult use cannabis, you can give us a call at Studio 2, 888-477-9499. I want to go to the phones right now. Michael is in Trenton and wants to talk with you, Mike. So Michael, what's your comment? What are you seeing on the ground? You're on Studio 2.
Yes, good morning, good afternoon. I live a few blocks from Weedman's joint. So, you know, I'm in the middle of it, and we have, I think we have one dispensary in Trenton also. And I am, you know, I'm really concerned that I don't think we need to be normalizing marijuana use. And I know that legal weed hasn't really hit its stride yet, but I'm already seeing stuff on the ground. You know, people in the parks, young people walking to high school in the morning, smoking weed. And, you know, I understand the social equity piece, and I know people who want to have want to keep that money local. In other words, people who've been in Trenton for a long time who want to run dispensaries, but I don't hear anybody talking about the other side of the coin.
So the ripple effects into society and the sort of the people
all day long.
Okay. Mike, could you respond to that? I mean, are we seeing anything in data or anecdotally that suggests there have been ripple effects into society from the legalization of adult use cannabis?
Yeah, so I'll start with the data. There's a study that comes out from the University of Michigan every year called Monitoring the Future, and they've been doing this for decades, and it's all about teen drug use. Their last numbers was that about 31% of high school seniors had reported using smoking marijuana, I should say specifically, 20% of sophomores and 8% of eighth graders. Now, that kind of basically hovers within a few points of what we've seen over the last 25 years or so. I mean, there was a big dip with COVID, so I think a lot of this data in the last few years is a little bit rough just because of the way everybody's life got disrupted. I think the big thing you see is vaping use is going up, and that's not just with marijuana and cannabis. I mean, that's all across the spectrum with e-cigarettes and nicotine. The quality of life issues, there is definitely a sort of this idea, an anecdotal idea, that people are smoking weed more. Now, there's no real way to get data on that. Now, I will say the New Jersey law is pretty specific in that it says it treats cannabis use like a combination of cigarettes and alcohol. So if you can't do one of those things, you can't smoke weed. So in a park, on a beach, in public, you can't technically smoke weed. Now, that doesn't mean that folks aren't doing it. And there might be some evidence out there that it's happening more, but there's just it's really hard to kind of prove that kind of thing. I think the other thing that's at risk here is that the police say that when this law came out, you know, police were saying the way it's written, they're subject to various penalties if they're believed to have profiled someone based on age. And this was a whole big holdup at the time that they didn't want cops throwing the book at kids just because they were underage and they were smoking weed. And actually, the way they rewrote the law, it actually includes alcohol use too. And there seemed to be this idea from police departments and police unions that, you know what, we're not going to be able to stop anybody from doing this because we don't want to put ourselves at risk. And I think you're seeing that play out, especially in your big crowded areas. You know, think about it's April. By this time next month, the beaches are going to start to be crowded. And I think you're going to see a little bit more of that. I know we saw it last year, at least anecdotally.
Yeah, and I want to bring in this email from Michael, another Michael.
Got all Michaels today.
Mike's are calling today. Mike says, I bought an eighth as a legit medical client and surprisingly got some seeds which sprouted. Is that legal? Can he grow? Can he use these seeds to just grow his own weed bush?
Yeah, you know, it's actually in New Jersey. It's the only state in the country that doesn't even let its medical marijuana patients grow marijuana. And it's kind of interesting because all of the reasoning against that from the legislators has been, oh, we've seen in other states that when you let people grow marijuana, you just open up the black market even more. And I think that might have been true in the early days of legalization. But what we've seen nowadays is that you're really just talking about letting medical marijuana patients grow 6 plants, 12 plants. It just makes it cheaper for them because we're talking about a very, very, very expensive medicine.
And we are talking with Mike Davis, a reporter, Asbury Park Press and the USA Today Network, who covers the cannabis industry in New Jersey. I want to point out that we're going to do a future show more about the health impacts of marijuana, really focusing on the industry today and the regulatory state in New Jersey. Wanted to bring in another caller, Jim, from Atlantic City, who has a question about enforcement in terms of driving. Jim, what is your concern?
Well, I am from the Atlantic City area, and you know, driving, in especially when it comes to the tourist industry, which is picking up in my area as we speak, in terms of monitoring impaired drivers. Mm. And I was wondering how in the world they're going to monitor and test people, and how they're going to enforce impaired driving, because if you're smoking marijuana, you are going to be impaired in some respects.
Yeah. Mike, I know you've done some reporting on that. That this is an issue of tension, isn't it?
Yeah, Jim, this has been maybe the number one issue, the number one reason a lot of people used about why we shouldn't legalize cannabis going back years in every state across the country. And frankly, here we are in 2023, and there's no real answer. There's still no scientific way, like a breathalyzer test, to tell if a person used marijuana an hour ago or a week ago. It's the same issue that we're seeing actually with like drug tests in the workplace. There's no real way to tell how you can to scientifically prove that somebody is intoxicated with cannabis use. there are some tests that officers can do, similar to a roadside test for alcohol, you know, eye tests and movement tests. But actually, the way New Jersey is, this entire program, it's called the Drug Recognition Expert Program. It's kind of, its future is a little bit uncertain right now. There's a New Jersey Supreme Court case that's actually going through the motions. They've had to go back and forth with having a monitor put together a whole study on this. And there's a chance that before too long, the entire system could be completely thrown out. And that's scary to a lot of people because there is no technology that exists yet. There are some companies that have poured a lot and a lot and a lot of money into trying to figure out how to make a cannabis breathalyzer. You know, there's talk of some saliva tests and things like that. But we haven't seen it used widely yet to anything even resembling something that you could, you know, expect in New Jersey in the near-term future.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Mike Davis is a reporter for Asbury Park Press and USA Today covering marijuana legalization in New Jersey.
Thanks so much for joining us, Mike.
Thanks a lot.
So coming up, our own Mary Cummings Jordan has a conversation with a local audiologist about hearing loss and our overall well-being. Stay tuned for that.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Earlier in the hour, we mentioned that U.S. Senator John Fetterman is back on Capitol Hill after inpatient treatment for depression. One of the things experts say may have led to that depression is the stroke that he suffered just a few days before the primary.
And strokes are connected to other complications, including, and I didn't know this, hearing loss. In fact, Fetterman, like millions of other Americans, has since been fitted for hearing aids. Studio 2's Mary Cummings Jordan spoke with Karen McQuaid, who is the director of audiology at Penn Medicine Becker ENT.
Karen, my understanding is a lot of people who need treatment don't get it, and this can be detrimental to, among other things, cognitive health. Let's start with the potential link between hearing loss and the risk for dementia.
So we don't know the exact mechanism, but there may be three different scenarios that kind of play into that. There might be sensory deprivation, kind of a you're not using it, so you're losing it kind of thing. There also might be information like getting degraded coming in, and so it's distorted and the brain can't process it, so it can't use it properly. And also a common cause, so there might be a shared underlying thing that makes hearing loss and dementia happen.
Hearing loss can also affect us socially.
Yes. We start to lose some confidence when we are in social settings if we're not hearing well. One of the first complaints that people will come in and tell us is, I'm having trouble in background noise. It's really difficult when I go into a restaurant, a family setting, a work meeting with people talking in the background, and they're not able to get every word, and then the stress builds. So I think people become more isolated, and we know the association with isolation and depression is very strong.
So when is it time for a hearing exam? Are the signs obvious?
So the signs aren't always obvious. I would say one in four adults thinks they have excellent hearing and actually don't. They will often get told, get a hearing aid, and that makes them defensive and not want to go. I always like to endorse getting a hearing evaluation at age 50. We start thinking of like maybe a colonoscopy at that age, but why not hearing testing to make sure that your ability to take in communication is working for you?
NPR's Mary Louise Kelly spoke recently on Fresh Air about her profound hearing loss and the fact that when it came time to get hearing aids, she had to struggle a little bit with the stigma around hearing aids.
That is a common feeling. Many people feel like it's associated with old age, and it makes them, it gives them pause. They say, maybe I shouldn't go. Maybe somebody's going to think I'm old. First of all, we see more working adults, more, you know, people in their adult years than we see geriatrics, because people are saying, you know what, I have to deal with this. Now that there's this known association with physical health, cognitive health, I better deal with it. And I'm just plain tired of having to ask for repetition. So more and more people are coming in, and then the devices that they can use, there's more options. So maybe they don't need hearing aids yet, and we'll let them know that. Maybe they need hearing aids, but they want the kind that pairs to their phone. Maybe they want the kinds that are down in the ear canal, and that may be appropriate for their loss. So it's there's options. So that's exciting.
The technology has really evolved.
The technology has evolved. They don't have to be things that people are, you know, announcing to everyone, and they get the advantage of hearing, you know, full time.
What causes hearing loss?
Sometimes it's as simple as some wax in the ear, if you have ears that don't push out the wax. If it's something that occurs with a cold or having had, you know, a viral infection, COVID even, sometimes people get ear infections. Those are things that we can treat. So ENT physicians are the appropriate ones. You would see an audiologist for the test, and then the ENT physician does the medical evaluation, and it can be fixed. So the kind that more often than not would need hearing aids is the inner ear or sensory neural hearing loss. The things that we do that put us at risk, like, you know, 50% of young adults, teenagers and young adults, are at risk for some kind of change in their hearing, noise-induced hearing loss from their cell phones, from streaming sound, streaming music. So wow. That's a pretty big number. Music at concerts, music that we listen to in the car may be too loud. You know, occupational noise, highway noise. If you live near a highway, that can be stress-inducing and hearing loss-inducing. So these are things. And also toys for children can be entirely too loud. Those little battery-operated with the little speaker, and then the kid holds it up to their ear, and they don't know it's going to harm them. So at all ages, there are things we need to do to protect our hearing.
So Karen McQuaid, are very young children that susceptible to hearing loss?
Yes, we're seeing 1 in 8 children and teens having noise-induced hearing loss. That's a pretty startling number, and then they have to live with that for life. So if we can prevent that, that's the message.
What are your thoughts about devices that sit in the ear?
You mean like AirPods?
Yeah.
So it's not that it's dangerous where it's sitting on your head or in your ears. It's the volume. If someone next to you goes, hey, I like that song, it's too loud, so you need to turn it down. And if you listen for an hour, take an hour break.
So tinnitus is a really common hearing ailment, and it's also very difficult for people to live with. Tell us more about that, Karen.
That can be one of the first things that people notice, and they'll come in and say, no hearing trouble, but this noise in my ear just started. And it can cause a great deal of anxiety. It can cause sleeplessness. It can cause people to feel like they can't concentrate. Some people, they're fine and they're like, I can live with this. It's not so bad. While others can be very, very upset, devastated, losing family, job. It can be very debilitating.
Describe the noise.
For some people, there can be crickets, there can be, often they'll say ringing, a humming, a whooshing, so there's not one sound associated with it, but something has changed there.
So last summer, the FDA finalized an historic rule allowing the purchase of over-the-counter hearing aids,
that's
meaning
right.
A consumer doesn't have to get an exam or a prescription or a professional fitting. What is your take, Karen, as an audiologist?
I'm happy that we are thinking of options for people. I like people to have options, but my concern is that they may be missing things. So we still advise, if you can get a hearing test first, that's the gold standard, and then we will be looking for that wax blockage, or there are sometimes hearing losses that can indicate a brain tumor. So those are things we don't want to miss. So we always endorse getting the test first, and then you can go whatever direction makes sense for you. Keep in mind that the FDA approved that class of devices, but they're not approving the actual devices. So there isn't a way to know if the device that you're purchasing is too strong for your hearing. So it's not going to be appropriate for everybody. traditional or prescriptive hearing aids can be more expensive. We've gotten hearing aids down to almost the level of over-the-counter devices now, the better quality ones. So maybe you're able to afford those lower-cost prescriptive hearing aids, and I think that's a great option for people.
Is it super important to get regular hearing checks? And if so, how often do we visit the audiologist?
You know, there's no time like the present. Maybe if you have good hearing, you know, come back in 5 years. If it looks like there's a mild issue, maybe, you know, one next year and see if there's a little shift. You know, keeping your hearing at its best, at its healthiest, will help for mental health, physical health, cognitive health. And it's best to try to get a baseline and then see where you go from there.
Karen McQuaid is Director of Audiology at Penn Medicine Becker ENT.
Thank you to Mary Cummings Jordan for that interview today. Learned a lot. And that's it for Studio 2. For more on our show, head on over to whyy.org/studio2.
And as I turn my volume knob down, I will tell you that our producers are Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. Our engineer is Diana Martinez. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us today.